This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. Dr. Jonathan Abel. I'm here with Dr. Bill Nance.
Hello.
And we got a special guest, returning special guest, Dr. Colonel Andy Whitford from DDE.
Hello.
And among many specialties, one of Colonel Whitford's specialties is kind of the British Army of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, particularly not fighting wars necessarily, but in Britain itself. So that's the subject of what we're going to talk about today. I mean, I know, Colonel Whitford, you've been doing some research on a particular officer. So if you could tell us who he is and a little bit about his background kind of during this period.
Okay, so this is a project that I was interested in starting a while ago, actually when I was in graduate school almost a decade and a half ago. I came back to it. Again, what she gave me was much, much better. But when I came back to it, I really started reinvestigating it in about February of 2020, mm-hmm. So I was able to make some research trips at that time to do that just before the world shut down. But the officer I was interested in was a guy named General Sir Cecil Frederick Neville McCready, as he became known to his contemporaries, Neville McCready or Make Ready. The name sort of lends itself to it, mm-hmm. And he was famous in the British Army really for two things. One. He absolutely hated his required mustache. Again, British officers used to be required to have a mustache in this time. Mm-hmm. And so the day the order came out that he could shave it off, he did. And was glad to be rid of it. And his retirement photo in the National Army Museum shows him without a mustache. And the other was that he was, at this time, the British Army's expert on sort of the use of force and bringing military leadership and this is one of the things I try to wrestle with in my research, is in a using military methods, but not in a militaristic way in British domestic operations, mm-hmm. To include at the end of his career operations in Ireland, mm-hmm. In the Irish War of Independence, and he is one of the figures there. Mm-hmm. But he is he becomes through initially because of where he is in the War Office, and then later on the experience he's gained, he is one of these officers that as domestic disorder increases in the early 20th century in Britain, and then during World War I, and then its immediate aftermath, and sort of what Charles Townshend and others have described as the crisis of empire. Mm-hmm. He is the British Army's expert on the use of force or the employment of military methods maybe at home.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's start very big picture. This officer comes of age in what is often referred to as the Pax Britannica or the Victorian Age, which will then become the Edwardian Age. This is the time when Britain is, if not the most powerful country in the world, certainly contends for it, has a very large empire, the empire in which the sun never set, although not the original one, that was the Spanish one. So what is his upbringing like? What's his military upbringing like?
So he has some relatives in the more distant past that were officers in the Napoleonic era. Mm-hmm. His father, though, is an actor, one of the great stage actors of the Victorian age, William McCready. In fact, William McCready is responsible for causing a riot in New York City.
Shakespearean, right?
Yes, the Shakespeare riots. Yeah. When his performance of Macbeth is greeted with disdain by New Yorkers because they do not want an Englishman coming over on stage and performing Shakespeare. Right. And so that's the riots in New York before the Civil War. That's his dad. Mm-hmm. And so McCready grows up in a town called Cheltenham, It's out in the Cotswolds. It's in southern England. It's a very beautiful place. Mm-hmm. But he has all these sort of artistic figures come through his house. Dickens reads to him as a child, for example. But his father forbids him from going into the theater. His father is a very serious, takes his Christian faith very seriously, and he does not want his son to follow him in this profession.
It's worth pointing out, during this time in England and elsewhere, there's a sense that actors are not true moral or Christian people because they put on another face, and there's a lie associated with it. It's a weird moral panic.
Yeah, and his father retires from acting eventually and is very sort of concerned about that. And so MacCready goes to school in Cheltenham. Mm-hmm. But then sort of ends up going to Sandhurst. And he, after completing Sandhurst successfully, joins the Gordon Highlanders. I haven't been able to sort of piece together how this happens, how a young man from essentially the south of England ends up in the Gordon Highlanders, but he does.
Right.
And has a somewhat conventional career as an infantry officer.
Now, does he face the same class bias that a lot of non-titled, perhaps we might call them Mustangs in the American tradition, people who didn't go to Eton or Harrow and who are not the 14th Baron of something?
I don't think he has. Again, he's certainly not on the sort of the elite of the army. Mm-hmm. But in terms of active discrimination, I never saw any record of that.
Okay, interesting.
He's, again, he does go to one of these, a fairly well-respected public school, and sort of works his way up, and really first comes to prominence during the Boer War, where he is in Ladysmith, along with a guy named John French, who's going to be important later on.
Yeah, so let's talk for a little bit about what the Boer War is for our listeners who may not be familiar with it. So this is a conflict. It's a kind of a British imperial conflict. This is in South Africa. South Africa used to be a Dutch colony. It's a British colony now. The native Boers, kind of the Dutch original colonists who are now seen as somewhat indigenous, are rebelling against British rule. Is that a good summary?
Yes, and so when Britain sends its army down, again, this sort of, this is the, a lot of ways understood as the end of the sort of one-sided wars of empire of the 19th century. The Boers, these the settlers down there have Mausers, they have Krupp artillery. This is where we're starting to see artillery really in terms of indirect fire. And the British have a very hard time initially either liberating their cities under siege or, in fact, engaging the Boers at all tactically, given their sort of technological developments of the time. Smokeless powder, indirect fire, the Boers' ability to disperse and know the terrain. And so the British Army eventually will win through the conventional phase of the fighting, through numbers and mass and sort of wearing the numerically inferior conventional Boer forces down, but it's a shock in terms of cost and in terms of casualties of what it takes, and is a preview in some ways of what's going to happen to a much larger extent than some of these earlier colonial conflicts. What's going to happen in about 15 years when World War I breaks out?
It's a massive doctrinal shift, because the British are basically having to shift from what has worked for them successfully throughout the entire 19th century.
Light columns supported by artillery, infantry wearing red coats.
Yes. And by the end of it, the British have figured out very quickly
they need to wear khaki shorts.
They need to wear khaki shorts, and they need to lie down, and accurate, rapid rifle fire is the name of the game.
Yes.
Well, let me pause real quick and ask both of you, former Officer Nance, serving Officer Whitford, why do you not want your line infantry, who are perhaps conscripts, to lie down?
Well, in this case, again, they're all volunteers, long service volunteers. And in fact, one of the things that comes out is a call for even more volunteers back in Britain that other people go through, including a young officer/journalist who's there, a guy who's going to come back in the story as well by the name of Churchill. But even professionals, once they lie down, the trick is getting them to get back up.
Right, and to keep conscript going. Armies, getting the conscripts back up is even harder.
Yes. Again, Britain has that odd again, they're all volunteers. Conscription is going to come into the story. In World War One, and McCready has a role in that. But getting anyone back up and to keep going on this battlefield where there are large amounts of fire, indirect artillery, maintaining that momentum is always challenging. And again, if you're everyone is on a line or marching forward, I don't want to say it's easier, but it's simpler.
And also, there's just the straight-up leadership challenge of you literally have to break almost, not quite a century, but literally decades of this is how we've done it. And leading a solid block of soldiers is very different than leading a dispersed group of folks. So it's a mental shift that has to occur with these officers as they shift from one model to another in combat.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's important for people to understand is a lot of times you'll find kind of the surface level critique of the British as being stupid. They're not being stupid. They're following what we would call their TTPs, their tactics, techniques, and procedures. This is what they do. It's just what they do is becoming increasingly obsolete.
And difficult. And again, leading a dispersed formation is far more challenging in terms of communication, in terms of example, in terms of just situational awareness than that more, again, the 18th century battlefield was a place with a lot of smoke and a lot of noise. That's why you need loud bands and big banners. Again, these people aren't stupid. They're reacting to their situation. But as that is changing, as the both the technology and the way wars are fought are changing, there has to be some change, but sometimes that's difficult.
So we've got MacCready, and you mentioned Ladysmith. What is MacCready doing in this war that is perhaps the first war of the 20th century?
So he's in focusing on the sort of the what we would think of as the conventional fighting. He's in defense of this town the Boers have invested and are trying to take, and he is one of the people waiting for the British relief columns to march up and holding it. With its again, with a military force and the civilian population there, trying to keep the Boers from taking it.
Lieutenant, captain.
I believe it's captain at this point.
Okay, so command of a company or?
Again, I'm just I'm trying to remember his exact position. Okay. I don't remember it offhand, but he is
part
one of the officers
garrison.
There. Yes, he's part of the garrison. Performs very well and is recognized as one of the officers most responsible for the successful defense of Ladysmith, and there he comes across a more senior British officer, a guy named John French, who's going to be the initial commander when the British go over to France in 1914.
So you mentioned earlier, I think you said he was mentioned in dispatches for this. Can you explain what that means?
Again, there's sort of two ways of recognizing high-level performance. One is sort of medals for valor or performance on the battlefield, but the other is to be literally mentioned in letters back to the War Office of saying these six officers from this regiment performed in an outstanding manner, and there's usually that sort of small bullet that goes along with it. So to be mentioned in dispatches is to say it's not the equivalent of a medal, but it's something that kind of goes on your military record.
So somebody back at the War Office knows who you are, which means when they look at promotion and assignment lists, they already know your name.
Yes, and it can be published in the newspaper as well
of
who these officers are and what they've done.
Okay, so this war wraps up within a couple of years. It's not unlike the American experience in the Philippines. Again, in many ways, it's one of the first wars of the 20th century. Where does MacCready go from here? Now that he's been recognized, now that he is, as they might say, has been blooded or has seen the elephant?
Well, in the second phase of the war, where the Boers sort of disperse and are waging a much more unconventional campaign against the British, MacCready becomes responsible for the military administration of a port and keeping order in one of the port cities in South Africa. And there is really, again, he's did something similar in an earlier campaign in Egypt, but this is the first time that where he has to manage sort of a civilian population who's not exactly all happy to see the British there. Port cities have a lot of different people coming in and out, keeping track of what's going on, as well as taking part in some treks into the interior of the colony to meet with people, to assess the situation. And so getting a sense of what it's like to have, to administer a military situation, but one that has a large, again, not really fighting so much as seeing and trying to keep smugglers out and keep track of all the people that are there. So this sort of military administration in a civil context is what he's seeing.
Okay, so you're talking maintaining order in a port. Are we talking, is this a strictly military formation that he's administrating? Is he working with local police? What does the force look like that he is running?
He's also dealing with a sort of civil administration, which is the big piece of this, where he is dealing with them who are not used to dealing with sort of military authority, but able to engage with them to help keep track of what's going on.
Is this in a command authority, like he is telling the civil administration what he's doing, or is he having to cooperate with them, or is there some sort of weird middle ground where he's in charge, but if he ticks them off, it's bad for him?
It's probably more of the middle ground, just that, but again, it's he does not have direct authority over the civilian piece of it, but he has to be there to monitor what's going on.
And you said this is the second time he's done this now.
Yes, he does something similar in, I believe it's Alexandria, in one of the early, in the campaign in Egypt.
How successful is that? I mean, it's hard to judge success sometimes, but I mean, sometimes the absence of trouble is evidence.
Yeah, it's a lot of this, one of the challenges that McCready has is, like his father, he burns his personal papers upon his, or he has his papers burned upon his death. So a lot of what we know about parts of his career comes from his memoirs, which are pretty frank, and from where you do have documentary evidence line up with it. But it's hard to judge success. But it was enough that I think the key piece is his lessons learned from it about how to manage these sort of relationships. Which, again, he doesn't always like, but he is able to do successfully.
Yeah, so how does he get put in this role, first in Alexandria and then later in South Africa? Is he just selected? Does he have any kind of study that would lend him to civil affairs?
Again, none that I've seen. And that's one of the sort of things I try to investigate is how this officer is able to react like he does.
Mm-hmm.
Why is he successful? And it's still something that I'm trying to figure out. But he is able to keep these things in balance, sort of military necessity and understanding that he is not the ultimate authority. Mm-hmm. And I think it's that, it's rooted from what I've seen in that ability to understand that there is that balance he has to keep, mm-hmm. that he never sort of loses his head and succumbs to, I must impose my will no matter what because it has to be done. He understands that there is this balance that has to be kept.
Do we know who put him in command? Is this like his regimental commander who might know him, or is this the administration?
I haven't been able to find that out. But okay. he does it successfully, comes back, and then sort of his next step, he returns to the United Kingdom, and then ends up in the War Office eventually.
Hmm. So it sounds like he probably has a patron somewhere.
Maybe. Again, and it's he is not one of John... it's probably, if I had to speculate, it's going to be John French.
Yeah.
He is not sort of one of the extreme high flyers of the time, but he is, again, John French, and he know each other from Ladysmith, and he is trusted enough to be brought into the War Office as a staff officer there in the sort of later half of the first decade of the 20th century.
So this is where the up-and-comers go, is the War Office?
Sort of. There's also okay. other ways up. There's also the War College,
okay,
mm-hmm. Which is another way up.
So a path to success.
Yeah. But there is also this sort of tension within the Army at the time of a distrust of people who leave the line and go either into staff roles or into the War College. Forster's The General is probably, again, although a novel, is probably a good example of sort of bringing out this tension where you have this young major who is very successful as a cavalry officer in the Boer War and then does very little unconventional in the intervening 14 years except distrust people who leave to go to staff college. And then finds himself, I believe, an army commander by 1918.
So a couple of points I want to drill down on. One, I'm familiar with the French army of this period, and what has evolved over the last century is a separate colonial force from the main line army. Is that the case in Britain, or is it all one army?
There is a separate army in India, but there are also battalions within regiments that rotate through. So your battalion might be sent to India for, I believe it's 5 or 6 years, and so that's simply where you are. And then, but then after that, those units will rotate back to the United Kingdom.
So there's not that same sense that if you're in the colonies, you're a completely separate force than the army that would defend the homeland.
There is, but they're tied, usually forces in India, if you're go to India as part of either the India, well, as a civilian with the Indian Civil Service or the as part of the colonial office, but you're going to be there. Mm-hmm. So up until World War I, the Indian Army is primarily used in the subcontinent.
Mm-hmm.
Again, but there is that regular army that can be sent and is sent all over the world.
Okay. So second question, you mentioned that MacCready has developed this kind of list of best practices for civil affairs, what we might call today DISCA, Defense Support of Civil Authority. So what are those?
I don't think it's, well, he's developing it.
Okay.
And I don't know if, he never seems to write it down until his memoirs, but it's that practice. Some of the things are that balance between military necessity and the respect of civilian authority. And I think that it's not neutrality, but it is that idea of treating all parties fairly.
Kind of being an arbiter?
Yes. And not allowing yourself to move to one side or the other, which is a big part of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I found myself writing this during the events of 2020, 2021, when sort of the questions of what does military authority look like at home,
mm-hmm.
Were very present in a discussion in the United States. So that sort of forms the background of some of this.
Mm-hmm.
But that idea of how does an officer make decisions and think through military force and civilian authority in a very challenging environment. Mm-hmm. Again, I couldn't help but reflect on that as I was writing this. Again, a very different circumstance.
Right.
And a non-American circumstance,
mm-hmm.
but still part of.
So a question I wanted to ask you, Dr. Nance, because I know your mm-hmm. your service history. You to some extent have done this in Iraq. You have been on the ground in a situation where you had a military role, but you also played a role in the civilian, not necessarily governance, but security of Mosul. So what are the challenges?
The problem you run into is, You're fighting people who are opposed to the government of Iraq. You're also dealing with internal power struggles there. The joke was that one of the local Iraqi battalion commanders we were working with, who was very, very good, was also a local sheikh. That meant that you had to be very careful when dealing with him. Are we dealing with a true enemy, or are we dealing with one of his enemies? Distinction.
Yeah.
And that's a challenge as you're, because what you don't want in that situation is to be seen as coming in on the side of an interesting power struggle that has nothing to do with the other power struggle you are involved with between the government of Iraq and the people trying to overthrow the government of Iraq. Rather, instead, there's a tribal power struggle that's also going on. Sometimes those are inextricably linked, and sometimes they're separate, and sometimes you can make them inextricably linked by your mere presence.
So what MacCready said of being a neutral arbiter still applies.
Yes, and is a lot easier to say than to do, particularly in the moment with limited information and with the added wrinkle in Iraq of not speaking the language and being from a different culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So MacCready has now, as you said, returned to the Metropole. He's on the staff. Where do we go from here?
So he is there in supporting the War Office during the Haldane reforms, sort of the liberal government that comes in the early 20th century into Britain, and is trying to continue what liberal governments have done since the 19th century and bring about reforms. And so part of this is reforming the army in the context of sort of Britain's not greater diplomatic engagement, but starting to have these understandings with first Japan and then France and then Russia as these go on, as it sort of deals with the fact that it is not as unchallenged both militarily and probably more importantly economically as it was in, say, 1850. The intervening half century, Britain has again has other competitors on the world stage now.
And I believe the United States is the world's largest economy after 1870.
Yeah, I think that's there. But more, probably more immediately concerning is Germany.
Right. Yeah, Germany has risen, and it's reordering the world in some ways. Are these reforms the debate, the same kind of thing that's happening on the continent, where you have debates between long service professional small army and big mass conscript, sometimes socialist influenced army?
It's less than that, than sort of how the army is administered. And Britain is still very committed to its volunteer army, to avoiding. It's this, one of the tensions, again, that I try to explore in the paper, is this idea of sort of liberal imperialism, that you have a very liberal liberal government at home, again, that is administering the world's largest empire at the time.
Yeah.
But that has these liberal values. And this is also the time when arguments over taxation are happening, over a time of how are we going to pay for these new ships, as well as how are we going to fund under two politicians, David Lloyd George and this other guy, Churchill, how are we going to fund the emergence of essentially social welfare, family payments, and again, they're going to have to be done by raising taxes. If you want to do both these things, you're going to have to raise taxes. And this is also a time of rising labor needs.
Yeah, and not dissimilar from the progressive era in America, where you have same things. Labor disputes, you have the rise of people who want to tax and spend, essentially, which is where the income tax comes in.
And then you have the rise of socialism and Marxism that are threaded throughout this, that are inextricably linked.
Yeah, perhaps more on the continent.
And then the problem, of course, being is you want to do some, but if you do too much, then you, of course, cause the destruction of that which you were trying to protect.
Yeah, I think it's less like there's not the concern about Marxism, although labor as a political party is starting to increase. There are, again, there is at least a few labor members of parliament, but the major sort of third party, because we really have at this point the Unionist Party, the Liberals, and then you have the problem of Ireland. And if we could just park that for a minute, because we'll come back to it.
Yeah.
But McCready is there to help with these questions of administration. And see how Parliament works, and see how what it's like to advise a minister, and again a very smart one, in the man who becomes Viscount Haldane, but again still sort of a little bit cynical, a little bit cautious about politicians.
So McCready's almost filling a role of what we would know today in the army as basically a congressional fellow. He is actually at the Capitol working with the legislators, the members of Parliament. He's doing this on a daily basis.
Yes. Yeah, so he's working there in the War Office doing this. And in this, that's the context of in 1910, in November 1910, when there is this major labor dispute among the miners out in South Wales, in a town called Tonypandy, and the local magistrate, the county sheriff of Glamorgan, informs London that they have lost the ability to enforce law and order. And so at that time, this is because it's at home, this is the responsibility of the Home Secretary. again, a former conservative turned liberal politician named Winston Churchill. And Churchill dispatches MacCready out to Wales, out to this dispute to try to restore order.
So let's talk about the kind of structure of the United Kingdom at this point. It's a relatively new organization as these go. It's formed right around 1800. It is the political union of England, Wales, and Scotland, with the addition of Ireland as a kingdom in personal union with the crown, which is complicated, and it's far more complicated than I just made it.
Yes.
So how does that work in terms of governance?
So in terms of governance, again, this is a focusing on Britain itself, on there, is there is that close relationship between England and Wales that goes back to the time of the Plantagenets. And at this point, though, the county administration, mm-hmm. It's less there's no Welsh government per se.
So we're not to the point of devolved government
no.
yet.
No. Again, and that's going to be one of the issues when we get to the 1920s and start thinking about Ireland. But this is a request back from the county, essentially, to the Home Secretary.
So there is no there's no kind of state level government here. It's just county level government up to Parliament or the Cabinet.
Yes,
but there is the cultural antipathy that is still there of Welsh to English.
Yes.
Correct?
So these are Welsh minors. Again, it's sort of that there is still that very strong sense of identity.
Mm-hmm.
And so MacCready, and one of the things the county constable Lionel Lindsay has a background that's in some ways superficially similar to MacCready's, but he is sort of known to be on the side of the owners.
Hmm. So let's talk about that part of it. So one of the things that we run into during this period, it's true in America, I think, as well as in the United Kingdom. Government often allies with business, or to put it in terms of labor politics, management and the government are on the same side. Sometimes they're the same person, right? So what is the traditional relationship, again, putting it in terms of labor politics, between the laborer, the worker, and perhaps the mine owner, the county administrator?
It's a more combative. At this point, it's an increasingly combative relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That you have sort of mine owners who want to reduce costs, who don't want to pay. And again, coal mining is one of the most difficult of all human endeavors.
Mm-hmm.
That it's sort of and again, this is a kind of continuity that carries throughout from the 19th into the 20th centuries of as this sort of both sort of a fierce local pride as well as a sort of an antagonistic relationship with the mine owners.
Mm-hmm.
And so generally sort of, again, in this case in particular, the local authorities are on the side of the owners.
Do we know what the specific individual problem that sprung up there? Was it pay? Was it working conditions?
It was a combination thereof. Again, this is both a specific case in terms of the challenges in the mines themselves, and also sort of a rising tide of discontent.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of these years are known as sort of the great challenges to this ideas of liberalism at home in England. But yeah, this is a case where essentially the striking miners, county constable feels that they can't, that their forces can't manage it. So MacCready comes in mission that if, again, combining forces from the London Metropolitan Police as well as the army, he can come in and try to restore order.
So are these miners striking like we might see a strike today? There's an inflatable rat and they're yelling at people? Or is this a strike like late 19th century America where people are being hurt and killed?
It's more property damage or rioting there. Again, there's a lot of both records and myth that goes around along this strike in particular.
As is true with a lot of labor history.
But there, again, it's Again, the question is, I think, mostly of property damage.
Okay.
So let's put a scale on this. How many miners are we talking about in general? And also, how widespread is this? Are we talking one mine in one valley? Are we talking multiple mines over all of South Wales?
It can vary, and it kind of there are multiple places where this is going on, although it sort of waxes and wanes in location, because this is also... The Royal Navy has not completely converted to oil at this point.
So this is a national security problem.
Yes. So the supply of coal that goes out into the ports also matters as well. So that's wrapped up. That question is wrapped up in this as well.
Mm-hmm. So a fairly, not necessarily a national problem in terms of widespread mm-hmm. national impacts, yeah. but pretty substantial area. So how, you said Metropolitan Police from London.
Yep.
And the army, how big of a force is he bringing into this?
Part of what McCready does is he tries to hold the army back as much as possible. Again, goes to both sides and says the army does get involved. There are some times when the army charges people, whacks them. Again, this isn't completely one-sided. The army doesn't get directed against the mine owners. But it's much more even-handed than it was previously. So again, to give an example, about a month after this all starts, there's a trial for some of the strikers who've been causing some of this disorder. And so to keep order in this town, McCready permits protests, well, not permits protests. Protests happen, and he does not try to stop them. But he also puts in this one town, a company and a half of infantry, again, probably about 300 soldiers, a troop of cavalry, so 32 mounted troopers, 10 mounted police, 100 metropolitan police, 100 police from Cardiff, and then plus forces that are dispersed around it. So this can be a lot of people because there are a lot of... This could get out of hand. So again, McCready right. wants to make sure that you have enough forces.
So what I'm getting is that he is the army. Is he in charge of this area then, where the Home Office has said you're in charge, or is he kind of a liaison? What role is he playing here?
He's in charge of the military force, but he does not have any civil authority because the civil authority, again, he is still part of this, and this gets back to. We just had a conference here at the college where we're talking about ethics. But some of the discussions centered around civil military norms. Mm-hmm. And one of the big books in the last 25 years on civil military norms is Elliot Cohn's Supreme Command. And one of his people he features is this guy, Churchill. And part of Churchill's method is, of course, asking questions mm-hmm. via memo. Other people have tried this, but Churchill was sort of the master of it. And so McCready is still sending daily reports back to London, telling them what's going on. So this is a case where there is still competent civil authority, and he is reporting back, and again, is expected to report back, mm-hmm. Where he understands that he is out there to enforce order, rather, or to try to help bring this to a conclusion.
So he's in this very weird space where he has... access to military force that he can use to assist the civil government, yeah. but he is not the military governor of the region where he can do as he likes.
No, and that's part of the liberalism of this, that he that civilian government is what is still the authority.
So I'm going to ask you to speculate a little bit here, because I think you said it's hard to get inside his head without his papers. Do you think he's doing what he's doing out of genuine conviction, or do you think he's doing it out of pragmatism?
I think it's conviction. I think he has this belief of, again, part of it is not wanting the military to get involved in governance, except in, again, Ireland becomes a little bit different. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit different of a case after the war. But again, a genuine sort of understanding of his role, that mm-hmm. this is not his role is to be the neutral arbiter, or to be a more neutral arbiter.
Neutral-ish.
Yeah. That's a good way of putting it, with an understanding that he is still subordinate to these politicians, this government, even if he still is a little bit. And his views on politicians are very conventional. Mm-hmm. He doesn't get nothing that you read in his memoirs about his views on particular politicians seems in any way outside what most people would say.
Do we know how much combat power he had available? Are we talking that he had... So when we say a company, half of infantry, is that a tithe of his force? Is this all of his force? Or is this like somewhere in between? I mean, does he have regiments to call on or battalions?
He does, but he's not going to use them all at once. And a big part of this is additional forces from the London Metropolitan Police as well. So, so forces sent out there. So again, there are multiple regiments upon which he can call.
So he has the authority and power to really just come in with a heavy hand.
Yes. But again, the idea is to hold the army back, which again, he does mostly, but the army is involved in some of these, putting either in, as a, in this case, like in the preventing rioting in the trials, a deterrent, or in sometimes meeting the miners. But one of the more interesting pieces of military capability he brings in are some junior officers. So people that have served with him in previous cases. One of them is Captain Farquhar, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, who goes on later to go to Canada, where he founds the PPCLI, the Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry, and is killed on the Western Front. That's one of the captains there. There's a Captain Wyndham Childs, who has a much longer name with a bunch of honorifics after it as well, eventually. But this is that, and he uses them as these junior officers. He also, there's also a home office official that goes out with him, who also is helping as a liaison, as a civilian.
So,
but MacCready is using these officers essentially as his eyes and ears. So creating, one of the things he sees, and this is also a continuity, is the importance of intelligence, of an understanding based on reporting from officers on the ground of what's actually going on. So when a miner says, when a mine owner says, you know, there are hundreds of people rioting outside my house, one of these captains can come back and say, no, there are none.
There are four people protesting.
Yes. And so this, and this is one of those other places where the practice of sort of empire, or how empire works, is MacCready's using it, where it's this network of information that he can draw on to understand.
Yep. So I want to get on two things in. So one, when he says, hey, owner, I'm sorry, you're wrong, is that then what happens with that information? Let's start with that. So he says, owner, no, you're wrong. No, I'm not going to send a battalion to go crack skulls in this town. Yeah. What happens to that? Is that just it?
It buys him credibility with both sides. The fact that he's listening to both sides, that he's there, again, it gains credibility. And one of the other things he does to gain credibility is he doesn't let the mine owners pay for his accommodation. So he, again, you go out there, think of going on essentially a business trip, and I can't remember offhand if he gets reimbursed or not, but he has to pay for his own accommodations. There's not a base he can go stay.
Does so a pilot defense travel service system voucher?
Yeah.
But whatever. He's also not staying at their estate.
Yeah, he's not staying at their estate. He is lodging in town and paying for his own lodging and being seen to do so. So that's part of this as well.
So second piece, you mentioned sometimes the army does go in. Right. So what does it look like when the army does go in? Are we talking people shouting at stoic lines of army? Are we talking the army clearing a street violently? What does this look like?
There are some cases where the army does sort of clear the streets, use bayonets. Again, the violence of Tony Pandy becomes one of the sort of signature discussions, sort of signature moments of the labor movement. This is when Churchill sends in, despite the fact that Churchill is sort of, again, interested in a more peaceful resolution, that this is sort of becomes part of the legend, the myth of this is when Churchill sent in the army to clear out the miners. There are some cases where bayonets are used either prodding or as essentially as paddles, but it is the use of the army against civilians, which the British developed a system to try to avoid after Peterloo in the Napoleonic Wars, 1819. It was called the police under Robert Peel, but it's not as bad as the myth says. But it is the army behaving in a way against miners that it doesn't behave against mine owners.
Real quick, Peterloo was essentially a street massacre of protesters who had the temerity to ask for a written constitution by, I believe, a cavalry unit.
Yes, they rode down these. And part of then the reforms, part of a more broad package of reforms in that earlier time was the establishment of we don't turn the army against civilians at home.
Do we know how many, were any people killed? I would assume there's at least some deaths in this. But do we know, are we talking massacre levels? Or are we talking fairly minor in terms of what we're looking
in terms
at?
Of overall numbers, it's small. It is, there are not sort of these large-scale massacres. But there, again, there is this use.
There is violence.
Yeah, and again, there are going to be, this is part of sort of escalating amounts of labor disputes in this time. So they talk about sort of the nationwide threat. There's a threat of a rail strike the next year, which again, that does threaten sort of nationwide commerce.
Right.
Does MacCready have an ability to, does he kind of have a trigger for, okay, we're going in and using violence, or, okay, I'm going to send the army here, but I'm going to keep them on a tight string, to I'm not sending anything at all?
It's more the middle. There's sort of not the formal planning process and sort of decision points that we would think of. But again, it's much more of the sort of man on the ground reacting to the situation, who also still has that responsibility to report back to London as this is going on.
How often is he physically present at these altercations or incidents?
At least at some. Again, but he can't be everywhere at once, and that's why he has these sort of other... one of the things he notices is that when he arrives, and this is similar to what happens when he gets sent to assess the situation in Ireland just prior to the First World War, of the importance of understanding what's going on. And so even if he can't be everywhere at once, which he can't, that understanding of, I have to be able to know what's going on, and that's part of the network he builds.
So you mentioned a couple times the importance of building this human intelligence network, which pretty much every counterinsurgency and imperialist theorist talks about. Does he empower his junior officers to make the call to use violence, or must they call back to him?
I'm trying to think of a good example. It would be more of the latter, that understanding of that there's going to have to be sort of that decision made on the ground. But again, it's trusting that good sense of keeping this in balance.
So let's you have your uniform on. Retired Colonel Nance, put your uniform back on. Do you think this is the right way to do this? Do you think he should have empowered his junior officers more, engaged in more what we call mission command, or do you think it was right for him to hold the decision a little more in his own hands?
The problem with working against civilians, of course, is everything you do is political. I mean, you could argue that every military action is somewhat political. But this is very specifically so. So, I mean, you want to kind of keep a very tight handle on this. But to the, and I'll let Colonel Woodford kind of finish it off, but the idea is that even in this day and age of modern communications, you cannot appropriately convey the feeling and the mood and what and the vibe that's happening there. You have to trust the guy on the ground, and you have to kind of expect that sometimes they're not going to get it 100% right, but the decision's going to happen literally in the blink of an eye, and if you wait for them to call, there's going to be a problem.
Yeah, and that's, again, it's that balance. And in this case, particularly thinking of a domestic, domestic context, you have to permit some level of disorder because people have the freedom to protest, they have the freedom to express their discontent, but you also can't let things get out of hand. And so the army here, although it's used in a couple particular circumstances, MacCready's vision is it functions as a deterrent, and the police are the ones doing this.
So if it does come to violence, he has already made a mistake in some ways.
Yes. Okay. And again, part of this is going beforehand and meeting with both sides, of meeting with the miners and saying, yes, you can have some level of protest at these trials or other events, or certain things have to happen. Like, you have to keep the pumps working in a mine, because if the pumps stop working, the mine becomes this, everyone suffers.
Right.
That's a little bit of sort of game theory. And,
right.
But and so some things have to be able to be allowed to keep going. Mm-hmm. But some things, again, it's not really a right to protest, but it's a the fact that it's going on.
So how does this get resolved?
Eventually, the miners and there is a negotiation. And again, there is kind of this ongoing tension. It certainly doesn't go away. But the sort of the immediate loss of control comes to an end. And so McCready goes back to the War Office. But again, sort of this doesn't stop industrial disorder in Britain at the time, to say nothing of these sort of there are other things going on as well. But the other big conflict in Britain at the time is over the future of Ireland.
Right.
That in it, because of electoral politics, essentially the Liberal government is committed to pass all these taxes and to break the authority of the House of Lords, which it really doesn't have, but tries to assert over budgetary concerns.
Mm-hmm.
The Liberals ally themselves with Irish home rulers. And so although Liberal governments throughout the sort of under Gladstone in particular, this very sort of titan of a prime minister of the 19th century, have committed themselves to some form of home rule,
mm-hmm.
The unionists have allied themselves with the conservatives. The unionists are ones who do not want to see home rule imposed on or voted in on Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
The language here, like everything else, gets a little bit loaded. But now the Liberals have committed themselves to home rule, and home rule has to pass in three consecutive parliaments to become law. And so it first passes in 1912. And so you have, because of settlement and events from the period even before Cromwell in the 17th century onward, the northeast of the island of Ireland is a sort of hotbed of Protestantism and this idea of unionism, of loyalty to the empire, to the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. And they have quite a few powerful allies, both in Parliament, in the army, and in society, people who do not want to see home rule. And so one of the things that happens is there's this sort of the Ulster Volunteer Force, this sort of paramilitary trending towards military organization that's seeking to get weapons that can stop home rule from happening by force of arms if mm-hmm. necessary. So it's, again, three consecutive parliaments means that home rule won't become law, and it passes parliament in a sort of fait accompli because of the liberal, the number of the liberal dominance in parliament.
Mm-hmm.
Which they have by virtue of their alliance with the John Redmond and the other members of the Irish politics. But this won't kick in until 1914. Mm-hmm. At this point, someone realizes, hey, we don't really have a plan for what happens if violence breaks out.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this incident where part of the challenge is because particularly the leadership of the army is drawn to some extent from the sort of the Protestant ascendancy. The question is, how much will these officers act against people with whom they politically agree?
Right.
And so one general basically says, hey, we need a plan to go up and secure the Northeast if something does go off. He tells his forces that, and mass numbers of one of the units in Ireland resign. And this sort of spirals to become a genuine political crisis. It becomes known as the Curra Mutiny. And so in the aftermath of the Curra Mutiny, the War Office sort of, there's this meeting between John French, who's the, again, who has to resign, but is the chief of the, essentially the chief of staff,
mm-hmm.
William Robertson, and I think one other person. Basically, they all sort of look at each other and say, none of this is our... There's sort of the meme where the three people are pointing at each other.
Right.
None of this is our responsibility. We don't want to deal with this. The War Office has put out some recent documents of how this is to be thought about. But essentially, the government realizes that this may actually devolve into a real civil war or some sort of direct conflict. Mm-hmm. And again, if you were to tell the average Briton, if you had a time machine and went to early June of 1914 and said, Britain will be at war next year, they probably thought what you would have been talking about Ireland. And in fact, sort of there's a failure of a political conference on the day where Serbia sends its reply back to Austria-Hungary. Mm-hmm. And the cabinet sort of has this moment of collective, oh no, something really bad is about to happen, which isn't until late July. But so the War Office realizes that it needs a better understanding of what's going on, and there needs to be an officer designated to take command if this does happen.
So they got the MacCready box in the War Office.
And they said, hey, we have this guy who knows about how to manage these sort of things because he did so in Wales in 1910. And so they send him on this tour of Ireland in the aftermath of the mutiny.
So let's put him... We're in 1914.
Yes.
Wales was 1910. How long was the overall situation in Wales?
About 2-3 months.
Okay, so about 2 to 3 months. And what rank was he in Wales?
I have this in front. I don't have his...
Field grade officer?
Yeah, senior colonel or brigadier, sort of okay. of that level.
So senior field grade, right in the kind of upper
yes.
level there. So, and same level when he goes over to Ireland?
More senior. He commands a brigade in the interim, which doesn't feature a lot in his memoirs. Again, sort of has a very conventional sort of assignment, does so successfully. But then when this incident in Ireland breaks out, is sent over. And again, part of it is a recognition that he has a lot of the same sort of conclusions of what happens in Wales. He sort of judges the Royal Irish Constabulary as basically ineffective in understanding what's going on, and understanding that, in this case, the civil government is not interested in flooding the northern part of Ireland with soldiers, sort of, again, the opposite of the mine owners who very much want the army to come in, and MacCready has to hold them back. The civil government in Ireland there does not want this at all, in and around the area that we can just kind of shorthand and say Ulster.
So he's I'm getting that this is a very calm guy.
Yes. Again, very, very sort of, again, clever. He very quickly realizes that the driver he's assigned is a spy for the Ulster Volunteers, and is using his knowledge of that to essentially communicate with them indirectly. Mm-hmm. And also meets with a lot of the people that are there who are not frankly inclined to treat a British officer from London who could be the leader of a military force. And this is a case where also the Ulster Volunteers are sneaking in arms. And interestingly enough, it's only the leader of Edward Carson, who... Again, MacCready says that he receives him with a great deal of politeness. And Carson reports back to this conversation to Wilson, another senior British officer who's kind of on the side of the Unionists, on the side of Ulster, who's making all these arguments, basically that if we have to send the army into Ireland, it's going to weaken our army to police the rest of Empire. And so... imposing this upon Ulster will put the rest of the Empire at risk. So he's kind of playing that game. But Carson receives MacCready with this sort of level of courtesy that is not shared by many other people. So they exchange, we sort of are in this age of growing disorder, but this is also still the Edwardian era, and so people are expected to treat each other a certain way.
Right, it's still a Downton Abbey dinner party.
Yes, it's this very odd mix of the two.
Yeah.
And this is not looking great. Again, the sort of conferences to try to figure out some way of doing this, again, has sort of... The king calls for a conference in the summer of 1914. It fails, and the day it fails is also the day when Serbia sends back its response to... the Serbian response or the Austrian ultimatum. And the cabinet collectively has a moment of oh no,
yeah.
And then 2 weeks after that, we're in World War I.
So where does MacCready go from here now that these two crises are kind of combining?
Yeah, the breakout of World War One puts Ireland for at least 2 years sort of on the back burner until the Easter Rising. But MacCready actually goes over as the adjutant general of the BEF. So the British Expeditionary Force, these initial six divisions into France, he is essentially the G1. He is the adjutant general. He's in charge of personnel. Does his job well, is not sort of, again, if you look at the sort of scholarship on John French and Douglas Haig, MacCready is not sort of, again, doesn't seem to be a big part of discussions about their generalship and about the sort of the conduct of the BEF, mm-hmm. but is responsible for, does his job well, serves there for just under 2 years. One of his challenges is, again, that members of parliament are coming over and trying to visit, including one member of parliament, and this takes up, I think, about two or three pages of the memoir, tries to visit the front and is arrested because he doesn't know the appropriate, sort of, again, essentially a member of the aristocracy put right. under arrest because right. he doesn't know the proper protocol. And that part of the challenge that MacCready remarks on for the War Office during the war is the vast number of MPs with either who hold a commission or who have military experience. Mm. And so that becomes this sort of challenge of civil-military relations. Eventually, he's brought back over to London where he works with the War Office. And again, this is a place where in his memoirs, you read it, he has these sort of very conventional opinions. Kitchener is very distinguished but somewhat overwhelmed by politics. Mm-hmm. Lloyd George, I believe he talks about, who eventually emerges as the Prime Minister, is inconsistent in method but committed to winning the war. Again, nothing... There's very little out of the mainstream in his opinions here. But the big thing he works on back at the War Office is the imposition of conscription.
So we've talked through him as the civil affairs kind of doyen. And the conscription piece is another fascinating part of this time period. In terms of MacCready as an officer, as somebody who does, as you mentioned, understand civil affairs and politics, at least to some degree, what do you think people should take away from that aspect of his career?
I think it's the idea of flexibility, of that ability to move between and do very well in somewhat conventional jobs. Again, he was a successful officer as a junior officer in the Gordon Highlanders, again, distinguishes himself in conventional operations in the Boer War, is a successful, very successful peacetime brigade commander, serves on staff in combat in this sort of massive, sort of the center of the struggle for Britain in the First World War on the Western Front, but then also has the ability to go into these more nuanced situations and still kind of keep his head about him and balance these imperatives of being the instrument of the government's will, mm-hmm. While still understanding the context in which particularly as Dr. Nance said, the political context in which he operates. Again, he is not reporting, trying to support a foreign government. He is supporting either the imperial authority or even the actions of the government back in the metropole itself. Mm-hmm. And this becomes his next phase is, and I realize we're still kind of grinding on in time, but in 1918, the London Metropolitan Police go on strike. Mm. And so, again, their pay has gone up a very minuscule amount during the war, and their cost of living has gone up approximately five times what their pay has gone up. Mm-hmm. So I think it's 13% pay increase and an 87% increase in the cost of living. Mm-hmm. Police constables and the London Metropolitan Police were sort of just part of a working class, were essentially part of the working class.
Yeah.
But this sort of level of economic hardship, the police go on strike. And of course, you can't have this. So Lloyd George essentially makes some immediate compromises, increases their pay, but also sees that the leadership of the London Met, this police force for London itself, that can also be used elsewhere, there are police strikes throughout the country, needs to be dealt with, but two, the leadership needs to change. And so the former head of the London Met is another former imperial officer. In fact, he's the guy who sort of brought fingerprinting to a large scale to India as a method of imperial control. But Lloyd George, although he knows McCready doesn't want it, but Lloyd George essentially leans on him and he accepts. Hmm. And so he comes in and sort of, again, like in Wales, uses sort of military principles of leadership, making the other commissioners go out and have specific geographical points, personal example, showing welfare, concern for the welfare of the constables and the other policemen. But he also has to keep this in track that he can't let them establish there can't be a police union. Mm-hmm. Goes by the acronym NUPO. He can't let this sort of be a force that can counter what the government wants.
Right.
And so through example, and then through improve through sort of personal encouragement and all these other factors, when there is another attempt at a strike after the war, about a year later, maybe a little bit less, the strike is unsuccessful. Hmm. And the London police, again, get this improved pay, but the idea of the ability of the police to strike is discredited.
Hmm.
This is interesting, too, because I found correspondence from someone in the Boston asking, because they've got the police, very famous police strike going on at the same time, well, how'd you do this?
Mm-hmm.
And McCready's bottom line is the credible threat of firing.
Hmm.
So he is also a guy, he also does some things to make the police less militaristic. He removes the sword from the police uniform. There's the great quote in his memoir of this is not a weapon for an English policeman.
Mm-hmm.
And so he doesn't want to see a militarized police force, but he is using his sort of these principles of leadership he learns from the military to improve them, to genuinely better their lives, but to also prevent a politically unacceptable outcome for the government.
Oh, it's been a fascinating discussion about an interesting and eclectic officer in his career. Okay. Colonel Whitford, thank you.
Thank you very much.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.